This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's a weird December when you step out the front door in the morning and feel like shedding your coat instead of adding another layer. The Department of Fish and Wildlife sent out an advisory this morning suggesting that people wait to put out their bird feeders. Normally, it's safe to do that by December 1st, but with all this warm weather, male black bears have plenty of food still to eat and no need to go into hibernation yet. So Fish and Wildlife says to wait until there's a good 6 inches of snow cover. Ha! When is that going to happen? Ski resorts around the state are trying their darndest to make a go of it anyway. Many have had to limit the trails that are open, and a few are completely closed. Our unscientific sampling of skiers and riders at Sugarbush on Saturday afternoon, though, said it was worth it to come out for a day, even with limited terrain. They did, though, also admit that the conditions are kind of weird for this time of year.
What I was telling people, it's a great day for the second week in April. This is something that feels sort of wrong about it all. It should be very cold right now, and there should be a lot of snow, but it's coming. Winter will come.
Well, I don't have a good memory, but I could tell you, last year we had at least 8 inches of snow right about this time, and things were good then.
Yes, I would like more snow, but I'll take spring skiing in December, I guess. You know, if that's what there is, I will take it. Yeah, it seems unusual. I mean, I don't know whether it's climate change, El Nino. I'm no meteorologist, but it does seem like we've had some pretty extreme weather in recent years, and I imagine it's related.
That was Will Sipsey of Lincoln, Jim Suter of Barrie, and Sarah Weigel of Boston, Massachusetts. We caught all of them while they were skiing at Sugarbush Resort in Warren on Saturday. Weigel said she's not a meteorologist, but Paul Sisson is. He's a forecaster at the National Weather Service in Burlington, and he's with us now. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Glad to be here.
So we heard from people saying, I don't have a great memory, but this feels weird. It's weird. Something's off. This is warm. Can you tell us, first of all, just so we know what the facts are, it's always a good place to start, right, what the statistics have actually been this fall?
Yeah, we had the second warmest fall on record. So we started off, you know, into the cool season with a really warm, cool season. We were the warmest on record for September and second warmest in November. So October was a little bit cooler, but it really didn't affect the whole average for the season. So it was quite a warm fall. And we've just continued that into December. We're right now the third warmest December to date through about half the month. The rest of the month looks warm, too, so we'll probably continue that. And we're less than a degree off the warmest so far for December. Probably the biggest thing that people are talking about is the lack of snow. So we looked at that, and we've had only about 0.2 inches, so less than 0.25 inches of snow in Burlington so far this year total. That compares to about an average of around 1 foot of snow should have fallen, you know, in pieces up till this date. Last year we had about 30 inches by this time. So we're quite a bit down. There's only been a couple of other years that we've actually had less than an inch at this time of year. We're also getting close to another record. Again, if you like snow, it's probably not a good record, but the latest we've had a 1 inch snowfall is December 23rd. So we're closing in on that all-time record.
And that's
as
in
well.
Burlington?
That's
there
in Burlington.
Have been some places that
some
have had
places,
an inch.
Right, have had an inch, but in Burlington itself. So, yeah,
but that
some
would
crazy
still give
records.
Us a white Christmas for those who celebrate Christmas.
If it were to happen, it would give us a white Christmas, yeah.
All right, listen, listeners, we've got about 10 minutes here with Paul Sisson. So if you have a burning question about the weather for this winter, I mean, he's no Farmer's Almanac, but he can help out here with what the patterns are. You can give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a comment on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Okay, so now we know where we stand, and it sounds like this is pretty off for a
it's
normal
pretty rare.
December.
Yeah, we're in rare territory.
Yeah, and some of the days in the past week, it's like you walk out in your winter jacket and think, oh, wait a minute.
Like this morning.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
It feels weird. Yeah.
So we also heard in that montage of skiers and riders at Sugarbush, people saying, I always think this is related to something. So maybe it's El Nino, maybe it's climate change. Let's start with El Nino because this is an El Nino year. So first of all, remind us what El Nino is.
So El Nino is an area in the Pacific Ocean, ocean water, which is warmer than average. It's conosicular. It goes in cycles. And it's actually timely to be talking about this because El Niño means the Christ child or little boy in Spanish. So it shows itself this time of year with warm water off along the equator. And that affects weather patterns, specifically, especially in the Pacific, but they have some downstream effects. And so that is the big story. This is one of the stronger ones, the most where the temperatures are more above normal than usual. It's one of the strongest ones. So, yeah, it has a big weather effect, especially in the western part of the U.S.
Yeah, where and it can have different effects in different parts of the globe, right?
Yep, no El Niños are the same. No two are the same. They have different effects. And if we look back at the El Niño years for our weather, we've had cold and snowy. We've had warm and wet. There's been really no trend that you can really put your finger on for the Northeast. But there is a slight odds favor, a slight being a little bit warmer than normal, especially in the last few El Niños. So we're seeing some of that warmer than normal conditions right now.
So we're seeing warmer than normal and we're seeing less precipitation. Some places out in the Midwest and West may be seeing more precipitation. Great for California, for
example. Right. They need their precipitation out there. It is their rainy season and snowy season. They need that for the rest of the year. So it's good to see that out there.
We've got a couple people calling in. Barbara's on the line from Guilford. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead. Your thoughts?
Hi. How are you?
Great.
Hello?
Hi, we got you. Go right ahead, Barbara.
I think I got disconnected.
Oh, well, we could hear Barbara, but apparently Barbara can't hear us. So anyway, try again if you'd like to call in, Barbara, or anybody else, 1-800-639-2211. Okay, so El Niño is a factor then, Paul Sisson, you believe, in our current weather pattern. What about climate change?
We've, you know, looking back at the records again, in Burlington, we've seen the trend in temperatures going up about 3 degrees on average over the past 100 years. That trend's actually a little steeper since like the 1960s and 70s. So there is that background sort of field when we make our long range forecasts. That is one of the factors that goes into the long range forecast is the fact that across the globe, temperatures are warming. And so that is a factor. Actually, the last several months, starting in May, so May, June, July, August, September, October of 2015 were all the warmest global temperatures on record since like the 1880s. So we've been on this warming trend globally, and it looks like this year probably will become the warmest on record
globally. Wow. But meteorologists often caution us that you can't attach or you can't make a correlation between global warming and any specific weather event or even perhaps a specific year. You're looking at a trend here.
Right.
And you're saying there's very clearly a connection. But any particular weather event or weather pattern for a year is variable.
When we talk about climate, we're talking about a 30-year average. That a lot of what different kinds of weather occurs in 30 years. So it's averaging out all the extremes to find the long-term trend. So, you can still have, like we had late last winter, early spring, we had a very cold snap. The rest of the year was warm, but when you average it all out, we get maybe a little bit above normal. So, yeah, it's the long-term trends versus, the day-to-day changes or week-to-week changes in weather.
Well, I promised so as not to alarm you that you're not here to be our old farmer's almanac, but can you give us a projection for the rest of the winter? Because, I mean, some people are really pleased. No snow plowing the driveway. This has been great so far. You can go out for some great winter runs without having to worry about spikes on your shoes. On the other hand, if you're in the snow industry, if you like snow, if you're just waiting for the cold weather so you can put up your bird feeders and not have to worry about bears, this hasn't been great. So what's the projection?
Well, full disclosure, I like snow. So so unfortunately, I have some – well, the way the outlook is we are going to see in the near term a little cold snap coming in this weekend, maybe some snow in the mountains, maybe even getting a little down in the valleys. But we'll have to pay attention to that for the weekend. And then it looks like it warms back up again next week, heading towards, Christmas Day. So not looking real cool towards the Christmas Day. All our long-term forecasts right now, when I say long-term, meaning the next few weeks, the next month, look like warmer than normal. And probably the average for the winter will end up being warmer than normal. That doesn't say we're not going to have snow. even if it's warmer than normal, if it's, 25 instead of 22, we can still get snow. We can still get big snowstorms. But our time's getting shrunk a little bit as we've missed a whole month of potential snow.
All right. So you heard it from Paul Sisson. Don't be too alarmed. There's still a potential for some big storms, but maybe a slightly warmer than average winter. Paul Sisson is a forecaster at the National Weather Service in Burlington. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
Coming up, we're going to be looking at why Vermont is ripe for a very specific crime, embezzlement. We just learned last week about a large alleged embezzlement case at Hunger Free Vermont, but that statewide nonprofit is in good company. Studies show that Vermont is at a higher risk for embezzlement than any other state in the country. We're going to find out why coming up on Vermont Edition. And if your town, company, or organization has been the victim of embezzlement, which often feels like a very personal crime, tell us about your experience and how you're protecting your interests differently now. We've got our call center straightened out. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Earlier this month, the statewide nonprofit Hunger Free Vermont announced that it had been the victim of embezzlement by one of its employees. Executive Director Marissa Parisi explained the discovery of the theft to VPR last week.
I was very surprised to discover what was going on, and I was grateful to our local bank, who about 4 weeks ago worked very hard to track me down and tell me that they had seen what they felt to be some irregularities with our checking account.
Parisi says the FBI is investigating the case, but she and they already have a handle on who the culprit is.
We know that it was a long-time employee that worked for Hunger Free Vermont, and that person had the primary bookkeeping responsibilities for the organization, and we strongly believe everything is isolated to that individual.
That scenario is sadly not so rare in Vermont. Barbara Arell is a professor of accounting at UVM, where she teaches courses on forensic accounting and fraud detection. Barbara Arell, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we're going to get into some of the specifics of what makes any company or organization vulnerable, but Vermont stands out as a place with a really high rate of embezzlement and at a higher risk for this kind of financial fraud than any other state, according to some studies. Do you have a handle on why Vermont in particular is so ripe for this?
Yeah, there have been some studies about why Vermont, and, it's just the nature of our businesses here in Vermont. We're smaller. We have less employees that we tend to trust with, responsibilities. And in fraud, what we typically say is the trust is warranted, but you've got to verify that trust, right? So I can trust that you will do your job as I've laid it out for you, but then I need to put some controls in place to make sure that that trust is worthy, right? Not just that you're a longtime employee, but that, I'm going behind and I'm actually checking that your trust is verified.
Listeners, we are talking about embezzlement in Vermont, why the state is so prone to this specific type of crime. As we just heard from Barbara Arell, we're a state with a lot of small businesses, a lot of trust in one another. She's saying trust is great, but you also have to verify. If your company, organization, municipality, we know this has happened in all kinds of places. If you've been the victim of embezzlement, let us know how you dealt with it and why, in retrospect, you think you were vulnerable. What kinds of checks and balances help prevent this type of financial crime? Have you put any in place at your business, maybe just out of concern that this could happen to you? Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Professor Arell, you talk about something called the fraud triangle. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. There's been some studies done on the people that actually commit the fraud to try to learn a little bit more about their personalities. And what's been found is that there tends to be three factors in every fraud. There's pressure or incentive, so the person has some need to steal the money. then they have the ability to rationalize the fact that they're stealing the money. So I'm just taking a little bit this time. I'll pay it back. I'm not hurting the company. And then the biggest part is the opportunity. So even if they, you know, have pressure or incentive, or they're the type of person that can rationalize stealing from a company, they still have to have the opportunity to steal. And that's where companies can really combat fraud by putting in internal controls. Right, the controls directly address this opportunity. So if we can, you know, decrease the opportunity for someone to steal, it's less likely that they're going to steal from us.
There must be some people who, I mean, clearly there are a very, very small number of people perhaps, but who are looking for a place to steal from, who may be eyeing a company because they think their checks and balances aren't in place. And then there are clearly some people who would never steal from an employer. Isn't that most people? Wouldn't most people fall in the I'd never do that category, or no?
Absolutely. Yeah, they tend to never, unless something comes up. And that's what we found is that, you know, with a downturn in the economy or with medical problems or falling behind on their mortgage, they create this pressure, this financial pressure on themselves, or, you know, just wanted to get ahead or take a vacation, you know, that they've always wanted, that, you know, they need the additional funds for it. So this incentive gets to the best of people.
So even those people who think I would never do this, there is a gray area for many people where that idea of incentive and rationalization comes in that fraud triangle you were talking about, that, you know, you say I'd never do it, but then all of those factors come into play and there's an opportunity and you take it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, we're putting a lot of trust in these people and they see the funds that are available, and with just a hole in the opportunity, you know, they look at it and say, well, I could get away with it and no one would really find out. So why don't I try it this once? Then when they try it once, they get away with it, and then they try it again. And then before you know it, we've got it going on for a year or 2 years, or unfortunately 7 or 10 years before you actually find it.
But now you're making me feel really distrustful of all of my colleagues. I mean, even here at VPR. And frankly, you're making me doubt myself. I mean, I would put myself in the category of I would never do that. But you're telling me that I'm, you know, one needy vacation away from embezzling from my company.
Absolutely. I mean, it can get the best of us. You know, there's been stats that 10% will never steal. 10% will always steal. And most people fall in the middle. And, you know, a company can address those problems. And, you know, there are trainings that you can do with your employees to, you know, introduce ethical dilemmas to them, like you have this opportunity to steal, will you steal? You know, you can help your employees to recognize situations they can get themselves into, you know, and what you would expect them not to do.
So is that actually helpful to do that kind of, I mean, we're going to talk now about what companies can do, but that's helpful to do that kind of training, like let's role play here where you could get yourself in a dangerous situation?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's one thing that, you know, management or the board can put in place. You know, here's training. We're going to pay attention to the controls that are in place, or we're going to pay attention to potential situations you can get yourself into. And, you know, let's look at how you would respond. You know, we do this with our students, and it's typically the students say, oh, I would always do this. You know, just like you're saying, I would never steal. But until you're actually put in that situation, you don't know how you're going to react. So the more practice you get, you know, maybe the better off you'd be when it actually happens.
All right, listeners, weigh in here. What do you think? Are you now fearing about your employees? Are you looking at your colleagues with the side eye? Or maybe you are in a company that, even though you're a small employer, you've taken some precautions to make sure that you're not likely to be a victim of this. Things like having a couple different people do the bookkeeping or have checks and balances within the company so that somebody else is looking over receipts at the end of the month to make sure that nothing is out of order, so it's not all in the hands of one person. Or maybe you're a company and you're so small you think, there's no way I could do that. So what do I have available to me to make sure that I am staying safe and keeping my organization, my municipality, my company safe from this kind of activity? Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. A few minutes ago, we heard Hunger Free Vermont's Marissa Parisi say that the person that her organization suspects of the fraud had primary bookkeeping responsibilities for the organization over a number of years. And Barbara Arell, that, you say, is a big no-no for companies that want to prevent this type of fraud. What should companies be doing?
Yeah, the biggest thing, again, is addressing the opportunity is the internal controls that the company puts in place. And, you know, it sounds like they had a system of controls at Hunger Free, but maybe they weren't following up on the controls or the monitoring wasn't where it needed to be. But the big thing in most of the frauds that we see here in Vermont, unfortunately, is one person handling too much of the responsibility for a transaction. And what we say in terms of controls, the best way to separate it is to have one person responsible for custody, one person responsible for recording, and one person responsible for authorizing the transaction. So, for example, with the checks, you can have one person that actually has physical checks in their hand. You can have another person that's going to record the checks in the checkbook, and then a third person who approves that check and actually is the check signer. So we're segregating the duties between these three. And again, we have smaller companies, so maybe we don't have as many people to segregate it. But whenever possible, if we can segregate these duties, it'll help us create these checks and balances. And then after, the best thing you can do is to have somebody else just look at the bank statement. You know, go online, look at the bank, what checks actually cleared the bank. Do you see anything out of the ordinary? Is there anybody that had a check that you don't recognize? You know, do a little investigation on your own part. That bank reconciliation that gets done at the end of the month, that's a big control that helps as well.
So even if you are a very small company, you could at least institute that where whoever's has the primary bookkeeping responsibilities, there's somebody else checking those bank receipts at the end of the month?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's a big thing. You know, you got to put somebody else in charge of just doing an independent reconciliation. Just look at what's going through. You know, you may not be familiar enough with the accounting to actually perform the bank reconciliation, but hopefully you have somebody on your board that maybe has some financial expertise, or there's somebody else that you can go to. But what check you're putting in is just looking at those actual physical checks that cleared the bank. Who was the check written to? Is it somebody that I know? Is it somebody that we work with? You know, sometimes people are stealing from the companies by creating their own fake company. So you might see, you know, something that's out of the ordinary. And that should be a red flag. And for you, it would just take you going and following up. You know, let's see the documentation for this check. Who is this actually written to? Is this an appropriate person? Just a step that you can take at the end of each month, at the end of each week. You can do it more frequently.
Let's go to Sue, who's calling in from Mendon. Hi, Sue. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. I used to work for a Fortune 50 insurer who insured companies against fraud, particularly banks. And one of the things we learned very quickly was that a lot of fraud is discovered if and when the person responsible ever goes on vacation. And it's just another indication of how completely they are allowed to control this flow of money and where it goes. And I think when I moved to Vermont, you know, every 6 months you read about a case of someone embezzling funds. In a way, I wasn't all that surprised, since people are given a huge amount of autonomy here for various reasons. First, we know them, trust them, love them. They're part of our community. Two, we really don't have a lot of people to oversee their work. And three, I think there's a real strong economic need. The other thing you were saying is that I can imagine doing this. Well, working in a Fortune 50 company, it's a pretty big monolith. And there were people that I knew personally who had been involved in this. And some of it, you get disgruntled. You look at all the money flowing through this organization, and you think, and I didn't get a raise. So you start to, you know, rationalize, well, I just need a little this month and I'll put it back. So it's that disgruntlement that can creep in as well.
Sue, thanks so much for your comments. Appreciate hearing about your experience. And Barbara Arell talks about that importance of having somebody else fill in while other people are on vacation, precisely for that reason you mentioned. Let's get one more in here, and then I'll come back to you, Barbara. Teresa is calling in from Burlington. Hi, Teresa. Go ahead. Your experience.
Hi. How's it going?
Great.
So basically, I was calling in because this really hits home for me. I'm a small business owner in Burlington, and I hired a gentleman who, you know, I kind of knew a little bit through business and thought I could really trust. And basically, you know, I started seeing signs pretty much right off. Like within the first week, he was leaving me IOUs in the cash drawer. And, you know, I kind of didn't think much of it because he did pay it right back. But, you know, I kind of mentioned to him that's not, you know, a proper way we do business. And, you know, I really should have kind of saw the sign. Seen the signs earlier, but then it kind of progressed to him pocketing cash transactions, and it's really difficult to kind of catch some of these, especially if it's not put into the cash register properly. And I've heard of other small businesses really kind of losing a lot of money this way. And unfortunately, there's not a great way to monitor this other than what we had finally done is put in security cameras, and my husband had caught him basically red-handed, and at that point, what more do you do, you know? And it was still really discouraging because we had to let him go. And you just the people you think you can trust are really the ones that take the most advantage, unfortunately, sometimes.
Teresa, thank you for sharing your experience. I'm sorry that happened to you. And Barbara Arell, I mean, both of those calls bring up so many interesting points. And Teresa mentions that sadness that a lot of people feel because these are often trusted employees. That's part of why this works for them for often so many years. But let's double back to what Sue said. You know, often these instances of embezzlement were caught when people were on vacation. And you actually suggest that that is one of the ways to have a check and balance in place is to have people either rotate through different jobs on occasion or take over for others who are sick or on vacation. Why is that helpful?
Yeah, absolutely. As she mentioned, it's a great control to have the person actually go on vacation or somebody else step into the role because then they have to perform the duties. And if there are any irregularities, then they're going to find out where somebody's actually having to cover up what they've done. And so we get these vacations as a potential internal control. You know, it's good for your employee. But it's also something that we want in place so that somebody else is doing the job. In addition, what you want to do is probably do a background check. You know, a lot of smaller employees think that, you know, that's costly and I can't perform a background check on every person that I hire. Well, that might be true, but if you're hiring someone to handle most of your bookkeeping responsibilities, you want to know where did they work before. You know, because unfortunately, these Vermont cases, we've seen where people have stolen from one company, paid a little restitution, done a little bit of jail time, maybe, well, and then gone to work for another company and then stolen from that company as well. So, you know, just when you're hiring during the hiring process, looking for gaps in their resume, you know, where were you during this year? They're probably not going to put it out of their resume because they were caught stealing from that company. But, you know, that measure that you can take, you know, if you want to go through a full background check, that would be helpful. But if not, you know, bringing in trusted employees and then rotating them through jobs is really a helpful control.
Let's get one more call in here from Stowe. Wendolyn's on the line. Hi, Wendolyn. Go ahead.
Hi. I've worked with small businesses in Vermont setting up accounting systems and had the unfortunate experience of working with probably half a dozen or a dozen small businesses who have run into exactly what you're talking about here today. And it's always heartbreaking. And it's a real challenge. I think people have made some great comments. I think the thing that to me is most challenging for small business owners is having the skills to do all the things that they need to do to be successful. And very few business owners really have the skills to hire and supervise bookkeepers or accounting staff in their organizations. And more often than not, they just want to trust somebody And so they do, because they don't know what to do themselves, and somebody's come to them recommended or whatever to do this job, and so they just assume they know what they're doing. And many times that's true, because there are a lot of great people out there doing this work, but without the business owners having the skills to verify the people that they've hired, both in terms of background checks, as the last caller mentioned, and in terms of their accounting abilities, they really end up behind the eight ball and vulnerable in these situations.
Gwendolyn, thanks for your call. Appreciate that. And yeah, bringing up a lot of issues again with that trust and also small companies. We also got a note from Scott who says, where are the auditors in all of this? Isn't that what nonprofits pay auditors to do year after year, to find out if there's fraud going on? So Barbara Arell, maybe that's a good place for us to end it. What about audits? I mean, this is something that is often done by many companies to at least try to uncover fraud if there is any.
Absolutely. And an audit, you know, hopefully will uncover the fraud, but we got to remember the purpose of an audit is not to find the fraud. We can provide some reasonable assurance that you don't have fraud, but the audit is really put in place so that we can make sure your financial statements are in order. So you could be asking about having more of kind of a compliance audit done. That's a requirement for some nonprofits by the state. They give them funds. They might ask for a compliance audit be done. You also, at the federal level, if you get any grant money, the federal government wants you to have a compliance audit done just for this very reason. But something that, you know, a smaller business might look into doing is hiring a CPA firm to really come in and do a fraud risk assessment. You know, look at my company. Where are the controls missing? You know, what can I put in place to help find it? Because an audit can be costly, right? So a full audit would be costly, but, you know, something along the lines of, you know, come in and look at my internal controls, that might be more in line with what the smaller company can afford.
So bottom line, Barbara, is, as you said right at the beginning, trust but verify.
Exactly. Trust but verify with some controls.
Barbara Arell is a professor of accounting at UVM, where she teaches courses on forensic accounting and on fraud detection. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermont legalized medical marijuana in 2004, creating a registry for people with certain illnesses who could qualify to possess and take marijuana as part of their treatment protocol. Right now, nearly half the states in the country and Washington, D.C. have legalized marijuana for medical purposes. This is despite the fact that federal laws still classify marijuana as an illegal drug. And it's partly because of that federal classification that there have not been as many studies on the side effects, efficacy, and interactions of marijuana and its components as there might be for other prescribed drugs. So the UVM College of Medicine has designed a course in its pharmacology department that will attempt to look at what's known and what's not known about medical cannabis and to dispel the myths that are out there. Karen Lounsbury is a professor of pharmacology at UVM. She's one of the two professors designing and teaching what's become informally known as the POT 101 course. And she joins me in the studio now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So why is there a need for this course?
Well, the first need is there is no course like this. I mean, it's a topic we teach about other drugs of abuse, and we teach about other drugs that are used for pain and used for disorders like inflammation and epilepsy. But for some reason, there's a taboo on teaching cannabis for its potential medical uses. So we want to change that.
That seems strange to me. Why do you think there's been such a dearth of courses on this, given that, you know, it's been more than a decade that it's been legal in Vermont for medical purposes, and in states around the country, in some states, it's been legal since 1998?
I think it's just one of those topics that people have stayed away from, and there hasn't been as much knowledge about the topic either. I mean, it's only recently there have been a lot of clinical trials in some other countries. You can't get any federal funding still in the United States to do clinical trials for medical marijuana. So there really isn't as much knowledge about the topic either. So we've been doing a lot of research ourselves in developing the class to try and find out some of those facts, find out what clinical trials we have, find out those that we need. And actually, our graduate students are going to be doing some research projects on trying to develop potential proposals for how you might do new clinical trials for medical marijuana.
Without federal dollars?
Well, they're not going to actually do the projects. they're going
to
be
proposals. But do they have to look for ones, proposals without federal money, or is this in a future where the federal government allows that kind of study?
Well, we don't currently have professors that are doing medical marijuana research. We do have a couple of physicians that are doing some small clinical trials, but there just isn't really a large research institute ability to do these types of research yet.
You mentioned that the federal funds aren't there. You're not allowed to use them for any of these trials, and that's one of the reasons that there really haven't been very many or any in this country. Does that affect your teaching at all in this course? I mean, do you have to think about where the funds for your course or your employment come from?
Well, this course is really about the students right now. It's not for our own research uses. We have separate, like Dr. Dossman and I, who are the co-directors of the course, we both have outside research that we do that's not related to cannabis research. So most of our scholarship work is not related to cannabis. So this is a teaching opportunity. And we do have several courses that we teach that aren't related to our topics of research. So most of what we've been doing is a lot of reading so that we get ourselves knowledgeable about what other people have done on this topic.
Are there any takeaways that you have now so far about what you think the benefits, the risks, the side effects are?
Well, there are some clear benefits for certain uses where there's solid evidence throughout all of the studies. Then there are some where there's potential. One example is inflammation. There's a lot of small research projects that have been done on inflammation, but the potential is there. And then there are some where maybe it just was, you know, it kind of came across as a possibility, but maybe isn't going to be a full-on use of medical marijuana.
What's an example of that category?
An example of that category is there's one single study that was done on reduction of metastases in cancer, and it's really interesting because a lot of people undergoing cancer chemotherapy are using it for pain and anti-nausea, where it clearly has effects. And there, it's one where there just isn't enough information yet to really say that it's going to be blocking metastasis. So when people ask me about that, I just say, well, it's a possibility. And it was a good study that they did. It just wasn't enough to say, okay, yes, use this as a cancer chemotherapy.
And those areas where it is clearly effective and all the studies so far have shown that it is a good medical use of marijuana deal with pain management, anti-nausea, appetite.
Yes,
appetite.
Well, appetite is a real problem for patients who are undergoing chemotherapy because they don't want to eat. And the anti-nausea effect is separate, really, from the promotion of the appetite. It's not just because they're not feeling nauseous that they want to eat. It actually stimulates your want and need to eat. So it has a separate aspect there. So patients who might be suffering from eating disorders, for example, it may also encourage them to eat. And patients suffering from AIDS, also, they have problems with having appetite.
Are there areas where you think there are particular misconceptions? Because I understand part of the course is dispelling the myths that are out there because there's this lack of solid research and information.
Well, I think the biggest problem is there has been a lot of pushback from people who are very anti-recreational use. So they don't even want to hear a possibility that it has a medicinal use. And that's really something where you just have to educate the population about that.
You know, one of the things that we know about drugs that have been trialed a lot and that have been out there for a long time is what the interactions are with other drugs that a patient may be taking. Is that something that is known about marijuana, how it will interact with what other procedures and medications a patient is taking?
That's a very good question. Compared to the current drugs that we have for pain and for anti-nausea, there seem to be fewer interactions that there would be with medicinal marijuana. It does get metabolized by the body, though, and so there is the potential that it may interfere with metabolism of other drugs. But compared with things like opioids and some of the other anti-nausea medications, it looks right now as though there's actually going to be less of a drug interaction there.
There's been a buzz about the course since the press release came out last week. Who do you think is actually going to take this first iteration of this course?
Well, the course is almost completely full, and it's really a pretty broad set of students, which is why we're going to have a broad set of requirements for the students. So there are some underclassmen undergraduate students as well as upperclassmen looking to take it as an advanced biology class. There are graduate students who are in our master's program and in our graduate program. And then we have continuing ed students who range from people who are part of the post-baccalaureate program for getting into medical school to those who are in psychology, to those who are in the legislature. So it's really a broad audience.
You mentioned those who are in the legislature. So they'll be auditing the course, basically?
We have two people who are auditing the course and one person who's taking it as a full-on course.
And why do you think it's helpful for people in the legislature to be taking this course? I mean, you left some spaces open specifically for those continuing ed people.
Yeah, I think because it's hard to get solid, reliable information when you go and look it up on the internet. You don't know if you're listening to someone who's pro-marijuana, so they're going to say everything is great about it, or somebody who's anti-marijuana is going to say everything bad. So it's really hard to find a happy medium. So we're hoping to provide solid scientific background on it.
It sounds like from what you've been able to find out, this may be the first course of its kind, this sort of pharmacology course on medical marijuana in the country. Are you hearing from other medical schools around the country, or do you think there's an interest in other people seeing what happens in this course?
Yeah, I haven't heard from other medical schools. I have heard from several researchers that want to get involved in the topic and some who have a background that they want to share their knowledge. So we're going to be inviting some people who have a background to give seminars in our department so that we can become knowledgeable about it. But the offering of the course, it just hasn't been out there yet.
Do you see a time when the UVM College of Medicine might be doing clinical research, clinical studies on the use of medical marijuana?
Well, as I said, there are already some small projects that are happening in the hospital, and I definitely could see if things move forward, especially federally, that you can at least do clinical trials for the medical marijuana uses, and also to kind of go around the back end and look at maybe antagonists for them rather than things that are actually going to act as marijuana. You might be able to get some studies at least going on at the molecular level. So yes, I definitely see a future for it.
Karen Lounsbury is a professor of pharmacology at UVM, and she's one of the two professors designing and teaching the medical cannabis course at the College of Medicine. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now it's time to read your comments to the program. Joining me is Vermont Edition producer Rick Sangari. Hello, Rick.
Hey, Jane. Let's turn our attention to last week when we discussed the importance of thinking and talking about death and dying. Dean in Underhill Center emailed, "I lost my son on August 1st, 2014, as a result of an accidental drowning. Prior to his death, Christmas meant lots of presents and other commercially oriented traditions, but now it means being with the ones I love. Nothing else matters. Death can occur without warning and is devastating when it occurs. As your guest said, tell the ones you love that you do, and do so today, not tomorrow. Tomorrow may not come."
The writer M.T. Anderson was also with us recently. Fans of his book Feed are now enthralled with his new book, Symphony for the City of the Dead, Dmitri Shostakovich and the Siege of Leningrad. Anderson writes about challenging topics and themes for a young adult audience. And Elise posted this comment: "What an exceptional interview with M.T. Anderson. I was all ears from the first words exchanged. I can't wait to put my hands and eyes on a copy of Symphony for the City of the Dead. Welcome to Vermont, M.T. I imagine I'll be reading everything you've written, past and future."
Our discussion last week about hockey got a lot of you thinking. We heard from Carol in Sharon, who writes, "I just got off the ice at Campion Rink in West Lebanon, New Hampshire. I play with a group of men and women with varying abilities. We are there to learn how to play hockey from our great coach, Dick Dodds, coach of the Hanover High boys team. I started playing hockey at age 39 and am now 50. It is one of the best things in my life. I love being on a team."
We also got into the topic of whether fighting is part of the sport or bad behavior by rogue players. PRH posted, "I was once told by a young colleague and hockey player that fighting is just part of the game, which caused me to ask why it isn't also part of table tennis, billiards, bowling, rhythmic gymnastics, all of which might arguably be made better by fights. And if you're going to fight, why not use the sticks and especially the skate blades more effectively as weapons?"
Now, we're going to assume that's a sarcastic suggestion. Though the vision of full contact table tennis, pretty intriguing, Jane. At any rate, keep your comments coming. We love hearing your feedback and your input on the topics we cover. You can post them on our Vermont Edition Facebook page or email them to vermontedition@vpr.net.
And this Friday is one of our favorite programs of the year, the annual music show. We want to know what songs you've loved, what bands you've discovered this year, and what artists totally amazed you. Email vermontedition@vpr.net and tell us what you think was the best music of the year, and we'll play it on Friday's show. Thanks, Rick. I know you're a big fan of new music, too.
I am. Yep. The one that I really love is a artist from over in Northern Ireland named Soak, and I can't wait to tell you about it.
Good. I can't wait to hear it. All right, so let's talk about tomorrow, though, for now. It is the holidays. Go ahead, let loose. Wait, why do we think it's okay to overeat, overdrink, and overindulge in every way possible from Thanksgiving through to New Year's? Tomorrow on this program, we're going to discuss the motivations for overdoing it during the holidays and hear some strategies that just might help you behave a little better this time around. Send your comments or your questions, your experiences about holiday excess to vermontedition@vpr.net. And listen tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening today.